This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Hello to you. I hope you're well this Friday afternoon. You've got me again, Georgia Hargreaves, here with you from now until 1 o'clock. Now stay tuned because very shortly you'll hear from a great southern farmer who helped save a homestead that was under threat from the Mindarabin fire earlier this week. And after midday, you'll hear about a vegetable farm in Victoria that's being taken to court by Fair Work for allegedly underpaying a group of migrant workers by more than $500,000. And of course, it is Friday, so just before 1 o'clock, we'll take a look at how things went at the final wool sale for the 2025 selling season. Up first, though, this morning, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese announced a new national gun buyback scheme, labelling it the largest since John Howard initiated a similar plan in the wake of the Port Arthur massacre. The buyback initiative will be consistent with the 1996 scheme, targeting surplus, newly banned and illegal firearms. Mr. Albanese says the terrible events at Bondi show we need to get more guns off our streets.
Australia's gun laws were last substantially reformed in the wake of the Port Arthur tragedy. The terrible events at Bondi show we need to get more guns off our streets. We know that one of these terrorists held a firearm licence and had six guns, in spite of living in the middle of Sydney suburbs there at Bonnyrigg. There's no reason why someone in that situation needed that many guns. There are now more than 4 million firearms in Australia, more than at the time of the Port Arthur massacre, nearly 30 years ago. The government will introduce legislation to support the funding of this buyback scheme and meet the costs on a 50-50 basis with states and territories. We expect hundreds of thousands of firearms will be collected and destroyed through this scheme. Consistent with the approach that was taken in 1996, the government is proposing that states and territories will be responsible for the collection, processing and payment to individuals for surrendered firearms. The Australian Federal Police will then be responsible for the destruction of these firearms. The National Gun Buyback Scheme is on top of the work that was agreed by National Cabinet on Monday, limiting the number of firearms to be held by any one individual, limiting open-ended firearms licensing and the types of guns that are legal, making Australian citizenship a condition of holding a firearm licence, accelerating work on standing up the National Firearms Register, and allowing the additional use of criminal intelligence to underpin firearms licensing. Australians are rightly proud of our gun laws. And until 5 years ago, Australians were rightly proud that there had not been a repeat of Port Arthur. They were rightly proud we're not home to the constant carnage we see in some countries. But there have been, of course, incidents in both Queensland and Victoria that have seen so-called sovereign citizens murder police officers. We will introduce this national buyback scheme to get guns off our streets and to help to assist to make all Australians safe. Minister Burke.
Thanks, Prime Minister. Yesterday we spoke about the motivation and today we talk about the method that was used in the horrific, disgusting anti-Semitic attacks of Sunday. The announcements today with the buyback scheme make possible what the National Cabinet decision referred to. If you're going to reduce the number of guns, then a buyback scheme has to be a piece of that puzzle. The reduction happens in a number of ways, in the limiting of number of firearms held by any one individual, in limiting open-ended licensing, in making citizenship a condition of a firearm licence, in accelerating the work on the National Firearms Register, and improving the intelligence sharing decisions that underpin firearms licensing.
The buyback is going to cause a lot of friction, I imagine, not just perhaps with some elements of the opposition like the Nationals, but also with gun owners. Even some of your own MPs, Dan Ripacioli, this morning said that while he supports strong gun laws, he doesn't support measures that are blunt, symbolic or designed to appease public anger. What is your message to people who may have to give up their weapons because of the actions of a terrorist?
My message is that in 1996, the then Howard government did the right thing. Intervened to have a scheme which Australians have been rightly proud of. We need to go further. My message is that the issue of someone involved as a sporting shooter like Dan Ripacioli is quite rightly proud of his representation of Australia. And he is a great local member, but he has a proud record going back. But if a bloke in Bonnyrigg needs six high-powered rifles and is able to get them under existing licensing scheme, then there's something wrong.
Prime Minister, yeah. Are you surprised at the lack of bipartisan support for gun reform at a federal level?
What I'm focused on is Australia's national interest. I'm focused on unity. People have decisions to make. This is not a time, in my view, for political differentiation. This is a time to bring the country together. I think overwhelmingly that's what the country wants to see.
Bondi, but I can give you an indication. In Western Australia, they have put $63 million aside for their buyback and they have 90,000 guns. So that gives you, ours would probably be a ballpark figure, you know, three or four times perhaps more than that.
And the firearms registry, will you put in place rules as to how often firearms need to be inspected? Sajid Akram's guns were last inspected in December 2023 and there are no rules on how often the firearms needed to be checked after they purchased.
So police try to check annually. They categorise and prioritise certain gun licence holders and they do those.
That's just a little bit of Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and Minister for Home Affairs Tony Burke addressing the media this morning. What are your thoughts on that? 0448 922 604 is the text line if you'd like to have your say. It's 12 past 12 on the Country Hour this afternoon, and a great southern farmer who helped save a homestead that was under threat from the Mindarabin fire earlier this week says there were some scary moments. The blaze tore through more than 5,500 hectares. Ongarup farmer Simeon Ma explains what happened when they arrived at the homestead.
We had to wait for the bombers because, you know, you can't be in their way. And then once they dropped that bomb, everyone just pretty much ran out there and started putting all the little spot fires out and stuff. Started creeping around the house. It burned a little bit of gear that I've heard. I think it was some old stuff, so not too much of a loss, luckily. But, yeah, we got on top of that, stayed on top of that fire, so we saved the house. That was a good priority, you know. And then we just followed the front of the fire pretty much and just kept helping whoever needed help. We ended up following the fire chief and that was about it for us. We did have some scary moments, me and the mate that was with me. Like, there was some scary moments where we had to leave the paddock because it was just too much and we had to just bail and let it burn. Cut a few fences to get out of it. So it was all right, but same with the scary moment of when we were around the house and the wind changed and the smoke come over top of us. We couldn't see nothing, but luckily we had, you know, two ways and stuff to be able to hear everyone.
And how did this compare to previous fires that you fought?
Just the wind, the intensity of the wind and the heat, it was just another level. Like, a few other fires I've fought just never had that wind and that intensity. It was just crazy. Because especially it was in the crop, so it was hot.
So then for you and your mate and the others that you were working with, what was the feeling when you managed to save that homestead, save that home?
Oh, it was a good feeling, very good feeling. I was very, like, stoked that they kept their homestead. You know, like, homes are a very important part of your life. And, you know, they had horse stables and stuff like that around it and all that. So I'm assuming they have horses and animals, you know, a few pet sheep that were there. you know, I'm just glad we got to save it. Like, lost some crop, but at least they got a roof over their head at the end of the day.
And it sounds like there were lots of units responding. How much of the community turned out to help in this crisis event?
Oh, a lot, for what I know of. Yeah, fair lot. Lots of people from lots of different farms come over and helped. You know, some of the older farmers, all the retired ones and stuff, still come out and helped. You know, and I got a lot of respect for everyone who comes out and does that, you know. You know, we travelled 40 minutes just to get there, but it was worth it at the end of the day, because by the time we finished, we were only 20 minutes from home. So, yeah, and it just travelled very fast, being very windy.
And then at the end of the day, once all of that work had been done to contain the fire, there was the very tragic news that one person was killed by a falling tree. How has that impacted everybody in the following days?
Oh, pretty hard. Like, it's pretty hard, especially if he's a well-known person, you know. Like, there's a lot of good people out here, and, like, he fought hard for what he did, you know.
Ungarup farmer Simeon Ma, he was speaking with Sam Girling about his experience fighting a fire in the Great Southern earlier this week. 16 past 12 on the Country Hour this afternoon, and in terms of the fires that broke out over the weekend in an area about 300 kilometres north of Perth in the Three Springs region, well, those fires threatened three houses. Shire President Nadine Eva, her property was right in the danger zone.
There were a series of lightning strikes on Saturday night, one which became quite a serious fire to the east of town Saturday night, and about another three or four strikes that became fires to the west side of town later on in the evening. One of those strikes hit in the middle of the old Emu farm to the west of Three Springs, and that relit on Sunday lunchtime, and that was the fire that nearly took our house.
Were you home at the time, Nadine?
I was home. I had been trying to provide some support for people fighting the fire. I'd got some water and some Zupa Doopas together, mm-hmm. and I'd gone to a high point to see where I could go when I got another phone call saying it's time to evacuate, get out of the house. So I raced home to grab the important things that you're supposed to take, the birth certificates, the passports, the computer, the dog, all those things that are important, and mm-hmm. we were leaving just as the fire came through the bush to the south of our house.
Wow. So that was close.
That was really close. Yep, yep. I have nothing left around my house.
Is the house okay, the house and garden?
The house and garden are perfectly fine, apart from being covered in ash and dirt. Mm. But if that's the worst thing, then we're fine.
Yeah, okay. It's just that the trees and everything around you is now bare.
Bare, and, of course, some of the trees are still continuing to smoke, and puffs of smoke and fire light up every now and then.
Yeah. With the summer ahead, are you worried about what the dirt will do around you in terms of wind, that sort of thing?
Worried's probably not the right word. It's going to blow. It's going to be horrible. We've actually talked about growing some elephant grass or some corn or something to the west of our house to see if we can block a little bit of the dirt that's going to blow. But I think until it rains and we get some ground cover again, it's just what reality will be.
Yeah. And just going back to that fire, it was coming through. You got the call that you needed to leave. But what saved your home? What did you see when you were madly packing everything into the car?
As we madly packed and I was trying to reverse out of my car shed, I probably had 7 to 10 fire units around my house. The decision had been made to stop trying to stop it and just defend our house and sheds. And it was amazing to see the people around. Obviously, I was frightened for me and my daughter that were trying to leave, but mm-hmm. I just saw this wall of people facing the fire, and I had quite grave concerns for how it was going to come over them as well and what was going to happen. But amazing, the community response. I can't get over, Chad and I are so overwhelmed by the support that we've had mm-hmm. and the people that have come and helped. I don't know, there could have been over 50 fire units on our property over the 3 days that we've been fighting it. We've had so many people helping in terms of helping cook food, deliver meals, bring water out, bring drinks out. It's been an amazing community effort. And we've had people come from Mingenew Morawar, Kanama, Karoo. It's quite overwhelming, really.
And I think challenging enough for your volleys that they had to save your house, but it wasn't the only one that had a really close call in that Three Springs area over the weekend. What was the story with the other two houses that were also saved? Were they all threatened by that same fire that went close to yours?
The first house that was saved on Saturday night was from the original storm to the east of town. One of the local growers was home alone with his three young daughters, which I can only imagine how terrifying that must have been. And they were trapped for a little while before they were able to get out. But fortunately, they were able to defend his house. The fire that went over our house then on Monday, because winds just kept changing. There was no rhyme or reason to where they were going. So backburns were effective, but you think you beat it and then it was changed and went in another direction. So the same fire that went over our house then came to our property to the west of us, one of our workmen's house to the south of the emu farm. Then it threatened their house. So they had to defend that house on Monday. So saved a house Saturday, saved a house Sunday, saved a house Monday.
Spaced it out nicely. Yeah.
Very nice. Couldn't have planned it better.
And in terms of what it burnt through, we've mentioned stubble and bush. Was there standing crop lost at all?
I'm actually not sure about cropped on the eastern fire. I should have found that out. Unfortunately, I haven't.
That's okay.
But our property, it was only stubble that went through. So, incredibly lucky.
Yeah. And on a brighter note, Nadine, how is harvest going? I know it's had some significant interruptions, but overall, how are things going when you are able to get onto the header?
We actually finished today.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So phenomenal for us. There's people in the district who've still got 2,500 to 3,000 hectares to go. Yields have been amazing. One of the good things that you can say about this year is that we've had some bumper crops and people are prepared to take it slow and steady in order to get the grain in and know that it's been a good season.
Yeah, and now you've got lots of hands to help clean up as well.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Really good to talk to you, Nadine. I'm glad your house is okay and everyone's house is okay, and hopefully that is the end of the fire season for you guys there.
Yeah, hoping so. Absolutely.
Yes, fingers crossed for that one. That was Three Springs farmer and Shire president Nadine Evar. She was speaking to Joe Prendergast about the season and also the fires last weekend that happened in an area about 300 kilometres north of Perth. It's 23 past 12. You're listening to the WA Country Hour. Now, under the state's strict new demersal fishing rules, Western Rock lobster fishers cannot keep any demersal fish that come to the surface in their cray pots. The no demersal bycatch rule is part of the WA government's changes to, which are designed to look after demersal fish stocks. It has halved commercial catches in some areas and completely banned demersal fishing on the west coast, which stretches from Kalbarri down to Augusta. Cray fisherman Jay Barrett is based about 120 kilometres north of Perth at Ledge Point, and he doesn't think the new rules make any sense.
Our bycatch is pretty well damaged after it comes up from the depths, and we throw it back and it doesn't survive anyway. So there's no sense in us throwing it back. It's just wastage.
So that is what was outlined to you, is that any demersals that came up with your pots, you couldn't keep them. You had to throw them overboard.
That's correct, yes. So from January the 1st now, retention of demersal scale fish during rock lobster fishing operations will be prohibited. So any demersal scale fish caught in our pots must be released immediately, and then we just have to record that on our CDR forms and stuff to let them know that we have been catching them, but we're just throwing them away. But, you know, the whole basis of this demersal ban is to supposedly save an endangered species, but we're not saving anything. We're just throwing away damaged product that's not going to survive anyway. So it just doesn't make sense. You know, don't get me wrong. Demersals, there needs to be something done because the pressure on that on the fish is huge. But we're in this position now because of policy created by our current Labor government.
How many demersals would you bring up on an average day's fishing, Jay, just to get a sense of how many fish we might be talking about?
We don't catch them all the time. On some days, you might catch, you know, two or three, depending on what bottom you're fishing on. But I've pulled hundreds and hundreds of pots this season so far, and I have not caught one.
Yeah. So the fish that do come up, and you're saying it's an occasional thing previous to these new rules, you would keep that, and what that would just be for your personal consumption? What did you do with it?
Oh, it is. It's for personal consumption, and it's for me to feed my family. I mean, we're a commercial fisherman, and here we are now not even able to get ourselves a fresh feed of fish on the West Coast. It's pretty ridiculous.
Mm. Were there limits to how many fish you could bring home?
Yeah, we used to take the same as a recreational take. So if we bagged out, then we'd start putting them back. But very, very rarely. I've never, ever bagged out a recreational limit and pulling my pots.
And do you worry, Jay, that that bycatch element of demersals in the rock lobster industry might lead to further scrutiny of the lobster industry, because we've seen that rule imposed with shark fishers, because demersal is a bycatch, that some people can now no longer go shark fishing. Do you worry that that may flow through to the lobster industry?
Oh, it's definitely a concern for us guys, but at the end of the day, you know, we're the best managed fishery in the world. Our bycatch is minimal compared to probably what the shark guys are and the net guys, because they're dragging their nets through the habitat and pulling stuff up where we're not. We've got fish. And we've had cameras in our pots, and the fish go in, the fish go out, the fish go in, the fish go out. The one that gets caught in there is just an unlucky soul that is in the pot at the wrong time.
Does this overall situation that we're now seeing play out with the demersal industry just highlight that need for better security of access for all fishers, lobster included?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, security of access for us guys is huge in our industry. I mean, we're still on that journey trying to get our security, our secure access. But for me, the demersal side of it, it comes back to catch reporting, and whether you're recreational, whether you're commercial, doesn't matter. You have to be able to catch report so the fisheries department know what's coming out of the water, what has been coming out of the water, what's going to come out of the water in the future. So until that sector has a whole different look and outlook on how they report catches, we're never, ever, ever going to get it to recover, because we have no idea what was being caught. And now this knee-jerk reaction to close it all down, to me, it's unjustified. There had to be some restrictions put in, don't get me wrong, but this has gone way over top. It's draconian in my eyes.
And, Jay, you're based at Ledge Point, which is a small fishing community. You're in the lobster game, but what's been the conversation and the feel within that community with these new tough demersal rules that we've seen introduced by government and will be enacted in a couple of weeks?
My fear is it's going to be round two of what happened when we went to quota in the lobster industry. I mean, it absolutely decimated Ledge Point. We went from 30 boats down to today, myself being the only boat here. There's nobody else. So that's 30-odd boats gone out of this community. That's a lot of money. And we were sort of now surviving on the tourist dollar with the people coming up from Perth, staying out of our caravan park, you know, and chucking their boats in and going and doing some fishing out the front here, because it's quite easy to catch demersals from Ledge Point. It's not hard. And, you know, all these people, they're not going to come here now. They're going to leave their boats in Perth, and they're going to either stay in Perth or they're going to holiday somewhere else north of Kalbarri, which is going to put a lot of pressure onto the Gascoyne region above Kalbarri, right up to Exmouth. Those fish up there are absolutely going to get hammered now.
So how important was tourism and fishing-based tourism, demersal fishing-based tourism, to communities like Ledge Point? What you're saying there, it's become a fairly significant contributor to the economy.
Well, it's a major contributor to our economy now, because we don't have the lobster fishermen here anymore. And that was where Ledge Point's money was always coming from, was always coming out of the lobster industry, but it isn't now. So, you know, our tourist dollar is the one that's bringing the money into town, and, you know, it's the fishing that brings the people here.
Ledge Point-based cray fisherman Jay Barrett. He was speaking there with Joe Prendergast. It's 12:30 on the Country Hour this afternoon. Time for an update from the newsroom. We've got Charlie Mills today here in the Karratha studio. Charlie, what's making headlines today?
Good afternoon, Georgia. A Perth man has appeared in court facing terrorism charges related to allegedly possessing violent extremist material. The 21-year-old is facing four charges, including two counts of collecting or making a document knowing it was connected with a terrorist act. He was also charged earlier this month with possessing or controlling violent extremist material. The Prime Minister has announced a day of reflection this Sunday to honour the victims of the Bondi terror attack. The government will also work with the Jewish community on arrangements for a National Day of Mourning in the new year. Anthony Albanese invited people across Australia to light a candle at 6:47pm on Sunday and observe a minute silence to mark 1 week since the attack. And the Australian Transport Safety Bureau has provided a significant update on its ongoing investigation into a float plane crash off WA's Rottnest Island that killed three people. Seven people were on board the plane when it crashed into the water off the coast of Rottnest shortly after takeoff on the 7th of January. In its second interim report, the ATSB revealed the pilot and one passenger died by drowning, while a second passenger's cause of death was drowning with a head injury. Four passengers managed to escape, and the full ATSB report is expected in the second half of next year. More news coming up for you, Georgia, at 1pm.
Thank you, Charlie. It is 12:59 on the Country Hour this afternoon. Still to come in the next half an hour, a vegetable farm in Victoria is being taken to court by Fair Work for allegedly underpaying a group of migrant workers more than $500,000. Stay tuned to hear some of the details of that case. For now, though, it's off to the Bureau of Meteorology for an update. Angeline Prasad is here with us today. Let's start in the north of the state. Angeline, what's on the radar?
Good afternoon, Georgia. The north of the state is looking pretty seasonal at the moment, so that's what we're expecting over the next few days across the north. Heading into the weekend, it looks pretty normal. Showers and thunderstorms across much of the north. So a fair bit of rainfall with those thunderstorms if they do become slow-moving through the Kimberley. Temperatures generally close to average, but the increased cloud cover means that the temperature is a little bit more bearable. Now, the conditions are a little bit more sunny across the Pilbara and the north interior, and we are forecasting thunderstorms through these areas over the next couple of days, but they're going to be generally on the dry side, and it is a little bit warmer. So daytime temperatures getting into the low 40s through these areas due to those more sunny conditions, especially during the morning and early afternoon. But there will be thunderstorms, but yeah, I'm not expecting much rainfall. Across the Gascoyne, we do have a trough that's extending through the Gascoyne, so we are going for showers and thunderstorms through that area, extending into the Goldfields and into the parts of the Eucla. Again, not much rainfall with these thunderstorms. There's a bit of heat that's building up again, so temperatures rising into the low 40s. So this is quite hot through these areas. But the trough will move inland and there will be a southerly change coming through. But for today, showers and thunderstorms through these areas as well. And they're again going to be generally on the dry side. So I'm expecting maybe about 2 to 5 millimetres through these areas, and the odd thunderstorm potentially producing 10 millimetres. But the main thing to think about is the risk of dry lightning, because they do tend to lead to wildfire ignitions through these areas. So that's likely to continue today into tomorrow and then contract northwards briefly on Sunday. Now, today and tomorrow, these thunderstorms do have the risk of producing a damaging wind gust, quite isolated, especially through the parts of the Gascoyne and the southern parts of the Goldfields today and through much of the Goldfields tomorrow. So that's the sort of the added risk in the environment today and tomorrow.
Okay, and heading further south, I know there was some similar sort of conditions with potentially dry lightning coming our way. What can we expect further south?
Yes. So the trough that is developing across the Gascoyne is also extending into the southwest land division today. So that's dragging in a bit of heat into the northern parts. So daytime temperatures today will be in the low to mid-30s across the central wheat belt, the lower west, and also through parts of the central west, reaching at least 40 degrees to inland parts of central west. And today we are expecting thunderstorms across much of the central west, much of the central wheat belt, through eastern parts of the Great Southern, extending into the Esperance region. So the trough is a bit unstable. And again, I'm not expecting much rainfall, generally in the 2 to 5 millimeter rainfall, although there could be thunderstorms that could produce up to 10 millimeters, but these thunderstorms will be rather isolated in terms of rainfall, more likely to get dry thunderstorms. So that risk of lightning is, dry lightning, I should say, is quite prevalent in the areas I've mentioned today. Tomorrow, we do see the thunderstorm area contract eastwards. So tomorrow, I'm expecting thunderstorms just through the Esperance region, extending into areas east of Southern Cross. And this is all due to a ridge that's pushing in that does bring in milder conditions for the Southwest Land Division over the entire weekend. So contraction of the thunderstorms tomorrow, the weather conditions do look a fair bit benign over the weekend. We will see a weak cold front brush past the south coast. So a few showers along the southern coastal districts and much milder conditions coming through for the weekend before the heat returns next week from Monday onwards with the next West Coast trough.
And just very quickly, Ange, just in terms of the grain-growing regions, I just want to know which towns in particular may experience those dry lightning storms. Which towns need to sort of be on alert, I suppose?
So today, much of the central wheat belt, so I'm looking at Dalwalanu, Meridin, Kalabarin, Kundadin. York might be okay. It's really, you know, sort of the areas north and east that I'm expecting dry thunderstorms. Expecting dry thunderstorms across much of the central west, so that includes places like Malwa, Mora, Kanama, and Yalgu, and then across the Great Southern, it's going to be east of about Katanning to Brookton, so Lake Grace, Hyden, are sort of likely to get dry lightning. It's going to be here and there, so not everywhere will get the dry lightning, but these are the areas of risks I'm looking at. And then through the Esperance region, it's basically the entire Esperance region today, east of Bremer Bay and Jeremunga.
Thank you, Angeline. Now, Richard Hudson is presenting the analogue show today during the cricket break, so I'll take you through the rainfall totals. There really wasn't much around in the south of the state, so we'll start in the Kimberley. Doongan had 23 mils, Faraway Bay 13, Truscott 35 mils, and Troughton Island 24. And then in the Gascoyne, Mount Narrier had 11 mils, and that's all we've got for the rainfall. Now, the Fair Work Ombudsman has commenced legal action against a vegetable farm in Victoria for allegedly underpaying 28 migrant workers by more than $645,000. Facing court is Bulmer Farms Pty Limited, which produces vegetables including lettuce, spinach and broccoli in the East Gippsland region. Fair Work Ombudsman Anna Booth says the underpayment occurred over 4 years and workers hadn't spoken up about it because they were afraid of retribution from their employer.
There was a referral that we received from the Federal Department of Employment and Workplace Relations in relation to conduct from December 2019 through to December 2023, so over those 4 years. And it was in relation to 28 migrant workers, actually PALM workers, the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme workers. And they came from Kiribati, Timor-Leste and the Solomon Islands. And they were underpaid over $645,000. Now, Bulmer Farms has repaid around $45,000 to those workers, but that obviously leaves a pretty big gap, and that is what we are pursuing in court, and we're also pursuing penalties.
So what were some of the working conditions that you found that led to this underpayment?
Well, look, the fundamental problem was Bulmer Farm's payment on an annual basis, so flat rates for all hours worked, and that amount was insufficient to cover the hours that they worked and insufficient to meet the minimum entitlements under the Horticulture Award. So the workers were paid anywhere between $884 and $1,105 per week. Now, that was for a 38-hour week, but they actually were required to work more than 38 hours, indeed, for more than half of the time, and in 7% of cases, more than 50 hours a week. So the result of that, of course, was underpayment, in particular of overtime rates and penalty rates for weekend and public holiday work. And look, Annie, you know, the reason that we are so concerned about this is that time and time again, we make it clear that people have to be paid for each hour they work, and that migrant workers, particularly, well, not particularly, but just, you know, all workers have to be paid the same. And it's just really important that migrant workers, particularly visa holders who are, guests, you know, invited to our country to support the industries that we have, are paid equally to Australian workers. And that didn't happen in this case.
Are these workers still working there?
These particular workers, I don't have visibility of myself. I suspect not, but the business itself is still running, still supplying its salad vegetables, and there will be workers there now, but I don't know whether any of those workers who are currently employed are subject of our litigation, I'm afraid.
This might be a question for the courts and lawyers, but what are the consequences that Bulmers could face if they're found guilty of these charges?
Yeah, well, look, there's specific penalties. I can only quote what the maximum is, $93,900 per breach, but it is always for the court to decide what the appropriate penalty is.
And how many breaches were there again?
Yeah, 15 is what I'm informed by my people.
Yeah, so that could add up quite quickly.
It could.
And I guess with Palm Scheme workers, you know, are they more vulnerable to these kind of breaches of unfair work and unfair pay?
Well, I would say that temporary visa holders are more vulnerable. The Palm Scheme itself is a highly regulated scheme, and in fact, we conduct regular reviews of Palm Scheme employers for the Palm Scheme owners, that are the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations and the Department of Foreign Affairs. But your question really goes to the state of mind of the people here in Australia under those visas. And we hear from them directly, as well as from their representatives, that they are afraid. They do fear they're losing their jobs and losing their visas. Now, in fact, we have visa protections in Australia. We have two new pilot programs run by the Department of Home Affairs to protect people's visas when they're being exploited, but often they don't know that. We also conduct for every arrival, we have an arrival briefing, but you can say all of those things, but when people face what they face in reality, you know, they can still be very afraid, because objectively they are precarious workers.
Fair Work Ombudsman Anna Booth speaking with Annie Brown. Now, Bulmer Farms sent us a statement saying it is working with the Fair Work Ombudsman to rectify unintentional underpayments to 28 current and former Palm workers. The company says 15 of the 28 Palm employees are still employed by them, and they say they are taking immediate action to quantify and confirm the exact amount owed to each affected Palm employee. The statement goes on to say, as soon as we have quantified the underpayments, we will immediately act to pay the outstanding monies owed to each employee. They say these were genuine mistakes, not intentional decisions, and they are correcting them. Bulmer Farms also says they have used Palm Scheme workers for more than 10 years, and this is the first time any concerns have been raised. It's 17 minutes to 1 o'clock. You're listening to the Country Hour this afternoon. Now, livestock shipping company Wellard Limited has officially been delisted from the ASX. The company asked to be removed from the stock exchange in October after selling its last live export ship, the MV Ocean Drover, in August. With the ship sold, Wellard no longer has an operating business, and the ASX requires listed companies to maintain ongoing operations. The company was once Australia's largest livestock export business, starting local operations in 1980 and listing on the ASX in 2015 for $556 million. At the time, there were high hopes for a boom in Australian live cattle exports to China after a new trade deal, but that growth never really took off. It's understood Wellard will remain a public, unlisted company. And a resource analyst says a merger between energy giants Woodside and BP could be on the cards after the sudden resignation of Woodside's CEO. Yesterday, Meg O'Neill announced her departure from the CEO role at Woodside effective immediately to take on the top job at BP in London next year. BP is the majority share owner in the Woodside-operated Browse joint venture project, which is in development about 400 kilometres off the coast of Broome. Rowan Bowater is the lead oil and gas analyst for Axella Research, and he says this could open up the doors for a potential merger between the two giants.
It's certainly a surprising move. Overall, the appointment of Meg O'Neill by BP signals a shift away from a transition-led diversification towards a more conventional upstream oil and gas model that we've been seeing. But if you look at Meg O'Neill's track record at Woodside, it's really marked by a capital-intensive growth strategy and, you know, lagging returns. So this raises a keen question for investors at BP, which is, you know, whether paring back climate ambition delivers a leaner, higher return model that BP is promising, or instead replaces climate-related friction with balance sheet risk through growth-led capital allocation to oil and gas.
And you've mentioned a bit of trend of trying to consolidate these giants. Does this place Woodside and BP in a position to perhaps merge?
Yeah. So, you know, while we can't say, you know, for sure what the intention is, and surely BP and Woodside would never admit that publicly, especially so soon, we're basing it really on, okay, what are we seeing in the market? And we've seen that BP has been a potential target for M&A activity. There was rumblings of a Shell acquisition earlier this year. We've seen Woodside has constantly been in talks about a potential merger. The most recent was Santos in December of 2023. And, you know, its main peer in Australia being Santos recently just had a takeover bid from XRG that fell apart earlier this year. So within that market context, it certainly increases the likelihood that it could happen. And if you look at their assets across each of their portfolios, it does, you know, appear to be some real synergies there, which could make sense.
Yeah, you mentioned a few that haven't gone through. Why is that? And do you think this one would be different if it was to happen?
Yeah, it's hard to say. You know, these rumours and rumblings, they do pop up every now and again. I suppose as, you know, we navigate this energy transition, scale will always play an advantageous role in being the lowest cost producer, you know, in improving your margins and improving your cash flows and your ability to distribute those cash flows back to shareholders, which is really what the oil and gas investor base want to see right now. So, you know, there is... I suppose an increased likelihood that it could happen. However, it's always hard to say. You know, two companies, each with their individual M&A rumblings, and now you've got the CEO going from one to the other. But making it clear that that's something we can't predict.
That was oil and gas analyst Rowan Bowater, and he was chatting to Kelsey Reid. Woodside says they have no further comment on this. It's 12 to 1 on the Country Hour this afternoon, and today might be the last day of school for many students across regional WA, but for students in Leonora in WA's Goldfields region, there's a reason to already be looking forward to hitting the books next year. This week, the school received the tick of approval to run a specialised gold mining training program. The curriculum was written by Leonora District High School Principal Mohammed Youssef, and he says it just makes sense for the kids to be qualified in the things they see and do in their everyday lives.
Like my background, I came from the Kimberley, and most of our kids, they spent time fishing. When I arrived to Leonora last year, I was trying to learn about the community and the kids and the families. And I spent a lot of time talking to them. And one thing that just kept coming up was, you know, our kids live in a gold mining. They know about the rocks. They know what the gold looks like. When I do a lot of home visits, that's what the family talk about. They go out prospecting all the time over the weekend. So, you know, that's the idea it came from. Like, why can't we build a program that already builds or extend what already exists, what the students and the family are really good at and passionate about? Also, in the last 2 years, we've been delivering remote drone pilot course for our students. So this is when the idea is like, well, this can be an extension for the next program, which is teach the students how to actually build a program to look for gold, do prospecting, using the drone to do mapping, surveying on the areas, how to go through the legality part of it, how to apply for a lease, how to actually go out and look for gold properly and do the mapping and do the planning for it. So this is where the idea came from.
Who actually had to write the curriculum? Where do you start with something like this?
I wrote the curriculum. So we're lucky because that's something we have in education department in WA. We have a concept called the Endorse Program. So Endorse Program is a vocational pathway, and you can, you know, create that creativity for us that we can build a program that suits our students' needs, our community needs. So that's when I looked at the program. I was like, all right, how we can write a program that suits us and achieve what we want to achieve. So we linked it, for example, to the HAS. So we're looking at our history in Leonora. And then we looked at how we can look at the gold mines sites here. What's the process in place? Then we're looking at some geology aspect of it, the different types of materials, and the rocks and the gold processes. I looked at the drone pilot, how we can actually use the drone to do mapping for the area. We were going to do the looking for gold. I looked at the survival part of it, which when the kids go out, do the practical. We're looking at doing a couple of camps where we go out for 3 days each time. So this, the program is actually evolving. The more you build on it, it gets bigger.
We know in farming communities, some of the high schools offer agricultural-based secondary courses. Were you surprised that there wasn't anything available for students to study mining in mining areas that have high schools?
Yeah, I was actually surprised that there was nothing, because we are the first school in the goldfield, actually, outside in Leonora. That's the first program we ever wrote down and we built that suits our kids and suits our community. Like, I did some research and there was no program, structure program, that for our students that recognize that sort of skills and build on that skills. I know there's other principals and the community, you know, regional schools are very excited about it. And the way we design it, it's, I know I call it Leonora, but it's more the gold field. So any schools can actually use the program. It's actually transferable between schools.
Now, it is the final week of school, so the kids are probably really excited about school holidays, Mohammed. But what has the response been from the community to the fact that this program will be available from next year?
We had a really good response from, especially with the local mining. They're really supportive and they're like, all right, what do you need? I'm like, all right, well, we need a lot of tools, because we didn't have any equipment to look for gold. But The parents were really, I spoke to some of the parents, I told them about the program and they're excited about it. I was like, yeah, right, that's great. Cool. I think the question's been coming up, what would we do when we found gold? It's a good thing.
I was going to say, are the kids going to pop it in their pocket, save it for pocket money? What is going to happen if the kids find some gold?
Well, that's actually interesting because, to be honest, I was like, oh, we'll build a program, but until now I haven't factored that we're going to look for, we'll find the gold. However, I think we have to make it very clear, like any gold will be found, we'll have to go to school funds. So that's something we'll have to really put criteria around it.
Leonora District High School Principal Mohammed Youssef, he was speaking with Tara de Landgraft about the Leonora Gold Mining Training Program, which will be available for students next year. And two mining-related companies and their director were this week fined over $2 million for engaging in unauthorised mining at sites in WA's Goldfields region. These offences are relating to Gold Valley Iron Ore's operations at Sandstone and Odell Resources' operations at Malcolm near Leonora. Yesterday, the Perth Magistrates Court found the company's sole director, Yuzheng She, guilty of mining without authority, failing to take all reasonable steps to prevent the offence. It is 5 minutes to one on Country Hour this afternoon, and Australia's wool clip is set to drop again next year. With new estimates, it could be down almost 13% on last year's production, which was the lowest in a century. But Stephen Hill, chair of the National Wool Production Forecasting Committee with AWI, says the price of wool has been strong recently, so it's not all bad news.
We've seen a dramatic increase in the market since July, August this year, and it's making wool and the merino in its total capacity is a wool meat and livestock very viable and very competitive to other farm outputs and enterprises.
There was predictions earlier at the start of the year that this was going to be the lowest wool clip in Australia's history. Have we reached that? Are we at the lowest clip ever?
Yeah, it's within 100 years, I think, we're at those lows. We were talking this season might be the lowest. We have revised that down slightly lower. So we're on the lows and lower than we'd hoped. And because of those other conditions I've just mentioned, potentially we can get a baseline now and improve going forward.
How much has the flock shrunk this year in this season? So we have seen a lot of numbers drop, but exactly how much has it dropped by?
Well, for the sheep, Sean, we talk as far as wool production, we're talking 10.3% reduction year to date. Well, that's the forecast in any case, Annie.
What does recovery look like for the industry going into next year?
Well, it takes a little while to recover, actually, because we've had poor lambing numbers. There's the actual ewe flock has been reduced. So you'd see recovery with all everything else being equal and the positive factors remaining strong as they are today. It takes a good 12 to 18 months to see significant recovery. I'd just like to see the numbers stabilise first. And then, but for any significant move, as I said, it takes 12 to 18 months to come through the system.
AWI's Stephen Hill speaking to Annie Brown. And the wool market has finished for the 2025 selling season pretty strongly, as Andrew Beaton from Nutrien Wool explains.
Yeah, well, the last sale for the season nationally, we offered 38,269 bales. Two-day sale over in the east, up two Tuesday, down three Wednesday, so virtually unchanged market, only down 1 cent for the week, to finish at 1,541. Over here, we offered 5,965 bales. We were up on a one-day sale. We were up 3 cents, indicator now at 1,715.
Not a bad way to finish 2025. What was resistance like?
Yeah, pretty nominal. There's 14.7% passed in, 4% withdrawn prior to the sale.
Okay, let's go through the clean fleece lines.
Yeah, 17 microns up 3 to finish at 2,100. 18's up 11 to finish at 2,011. 19's up 13 to finish at 1,899. A 20's up 5 to finish at 1,849. and 21's up five as well to finish at 18.39, and the 22's up four to finish 18.34. So just mediocre rises right through all the micron.
Yeah. What about the omit lines?
Pieces and bellies pretty much unchanged there, just the 18 microns gained 10 cents. Locks, they were down 10. Lambs and crutchings unchanged.
And who was buying for the final sale of 2025?
Yeah, Techwool Trading once again right up there at the top. PJ Morris pretty close to far behind, and United Wool Company.
Right. Okay, haven't heard of them for a while. Heading into a bit of a recess now. When do sales resume?
Yeah, we've got a three-week recess. The first sale for us in the West will be on the 13th of January. Now, just take this opportunity too to say very Merry Christmas to all the listeners out there. Everyone stay safe, and I'm really looking forward to the wool market, how it's going to start off next year.
Andrew Beaton from Nutrien Wool speaking with Tara DeLandgraft. Thanks for your company on the Country Hour this week. It's been lovely having you. I'm Georgia Hargreaves, and I will catch you on Monday. It's 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.